There has also been little transparency at other schools about how federal stimulus dollars are actually being spent. Barbara Bowen, the president of the Professional Staff Congress, PSC, at the City University of New York, says that out of $251 million that CUNY received in the CARES Act, the first round of federal stimulus funding, around $72 million has not been spent. Instead of investing it right away in the pretty broad list of things that is in the federal legislation that can be covered by the CARES Act money, they held onto it as a hedge against future budget cuts while CUNY suffered, Bowen says. There has not been transparency. We are demanding now that they invest it in ways that will really serve the needs of the community. CUNY did not respond to an emailed request for comment. The financial needs of CUNY workers are apparent, having felt the impact of government. Andrew Cuomo's decision early in the pandemic to withhold 20% of state funding for CUNY's budget, around 2,800 adjuncts were told over the summer that they would not be reappointed, though around 1,000 have since been reinstated. In the winter, CUNY told employees it was planning to violate PSC's contract and not implement a 2% salary increase that was meant to go into effect on November 15th. In February of this year, CUNY announced it would withhold $1,000 equity pay increases that had been scheduled for a group of 2,500 workers, lecturers, and office workers who are primarily women and people of color. The PSC staged a successful, wide-ranging campaign against the equity pay delay. The whole union fought back. That was the key, Bowen says. We knew that a breach in the contract against the lower-paid workers, people of color in particular, the majority women in a couple of these titles, to do that in this moment when families are struggling so hard in New York was completely unacceptable. The American Association of University Professors, American Federation of Teachers Union at Rutgers University in New Jersey has also had significant wins against COVID-related austerity measures this spring, after a year spent working with 18 other unions across campus. When the pandemic first hit, the coalition of unions presented the university with a work-share proposal where workers would take voluntary furloughs but would offset the income losses with federal unemployment. The university rejected it, instead declaring a fiscal emergency, laying off 1,000 people and canceling raises for union workers. Todd Wolfson, an associate professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers and the president of Rutgers AAUPAFT, says the financial decisions the school made were predictable. We knew what they were gonna do when the pandemic hit, because it's what they always do, which is they were going to make draconian, austerity-driven cuts, and they were going to go after the most vulnerable workers at the university, he says.
We give people.
DMX Life Lessons.
American rapper and actor DMX recently died at the age of 50 after decades of struggling with crack cocaine addiction. Born L. Simmons in New York in 1970, DMX struggled most of his life with drug addiction.
I'm tired of lying to myself.
thinking I could do it on my own. When I get left alone, it's when the devil peeks in and creeps in, knocks on the door like Legion, sneaks in. And it's usually around the weekend that I get reckless and jump off the deep end. Lord, if you hear me, you know that I'm coming to you sincerely. I need you near me. Please feel me. I'm sick and I need you to heal me.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi on We The People. DMX's death has revived the debate about war on drug and addiction in the United States. From the crack cocaine epidemic of the past to today's opioid crisis, which officials prefer not to talk about. In this episode, we'll try to find out what role race plays in all of this. Stay with us.
DMX reportedly OD'd at home and was hospitalized for a week until his body functions ultimately failed. According to a hospital statement, DMX died peacefully after he had a catastrophic cardiac arrest. His death deeply saddened his family and fans. He resorted to robbery and violence, just like many other heavy drug addicts of his generation.
DMX spent a significant portion of his life committing crimes, serving time in correctional institutions, and battling addiction. An unspecified overdose ultimately ended his life, but the tragic story of addiction to heavy drugs will be remembered in America. We're now joined by Daniel Shaw, a professor of race, ethnicity, class, and gender at Hostos Community College of the City University of New York. Welcome, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Mr. Shaw, what role do the Hollywood and the U.S. music industry play in promoting drugs, a point also brought up by DMX himself?
The hip-hop industry, what Chuck D called the CNN of the hood, and its potential to educate and raise consciousness across this country, was hijacked post-1990s. The music industry magnates were able to hijack that revolutionary energy and substitute it with something that's completely different today, where misogyny and the rampant abuse of drugs and hyper violence is super glorified.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Shaw.
The celebrity's death revived debates about decades of U.S. failure in the war on drugs. Simmons' childhood coincided with a surge in crack cocaine use in major cities across the United States. The surge of the new smokable form of cocaine impacted African-American communities far more than others.
Low-income, inner-city neighborhoods where black families were largely located due to racial segregation and discriminatory practices of the time were soon filled with crack cocaine. One victim was Simmons. Although he sold millions of records and was nominated for 3 Grammy Awards, he led a tragic life with suffering. Our next guest is Matt Taibbi, an American journalist and podcaster. He's also the author of 9 books, including 4 New York Times bestsellers. His latest book coming out this year is titled The Business Secrets of Drug Dealing, an Almost True Account. Mr. Taibbi, welcome to the show.
Anytime.
Many thanks. First of all, why are celebrities in America associated with drugs so much?
Well, we've had lots and lots of celebrities who have died as a result of drug abuse. Going back to the 70s, we've had major rock stars from Jimi Hendrix to Janis Joplin, more recently Michael Jackson, Prince. I mean, they all had substance abuse problems. DMX. Yeah, I don't know how many we've had that have involved crack exactly. And crack is a different drug. It's politically charged for a couple of reasons. Number one, they had this ridiculous sentencing disparity with crack versus cocaine. People are taking drugs not because they're uneducated about what drugs do, but because they have problems in their lives. They have economic problems. They have problems of professional stress. That's kind of the issue with drug use. It's not that people don't know that this can kill you. Of course they know.
Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Taibbi.
The crack cocaine epidemic gave former President Reagan a great chance to take on the African-American community. Large numbers of young black men were imprisoned for long sentences, drug crimes exacerbated, and police brutality against the black community surged, resulting in injury and death for many black men, women, and children.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children. From the beginning of our administration, we've taken strong steps to do something about this horror. Tonight, I can report to you that we've made much progress. 37 federal agencies are working together in a vigorous national effort. And by next year, our spending for drug law enforcement will have more than tripled from its 1981 levels. We have increased seizures of illegal drugs. Shortages of marijuana are now being reported. Last year alone, over 10,000 drug criminals were convicted, and nearly $250 million of their assets were seized by the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Since African Americans were the majority users of crack cocaine, the racist criminal justice system created laws that were specific to crack and found an effective way to imprison thousands of black people. So is it a war on drugs or on African Americans?
This has never been a war on drugs. Since Ronald Reagan, this has been a war on poor people, on black people, on the black community, on the most oppressed communities. I'm actually a few blocks away from where DMX grew up, in Yonkers, in one of the most oppressed, disadvantaged communities. And drugs have destroyed the lives of how many hundreds of thousands of families across this country. And that's actually part of the state machinery or the ruling class machinery in this country.
The U.S. so-called war on drugs is a war many believe is already doomed to fail. Multiple researches since mid-80s show that the U.S. war on drugs has been a failure, with experts arguing that money should be spent on treatment rather than using armed forces to tackle the issue.
This is crack cocaine, seized a few days ago by drug enforcement agents in a park just across the street from the White House. It could easily have been heroin or PCP. It's as innocent looking as candy, but it's turning our cities into battle zones, and it's murdering our children. Let there be no mistake, this stuff is poison. Some used to call drugs harmless recreation. They're not. Drugs are a real and terribly dangerous threat to our neighborhoods, our friends, and our families.
The government-led initiative that aims to stop illegal drug use, distribution, and trade has only resulted in increasing prison sentences. Incarceration of the drug users has proven to be of no use neither for the patient nor the society. What can you say about drug laws in the U.S.?
I mean, there's no question that the drug laws are designed to give police an opportunity to arrest people without means for doing exactly the same things that wealthy people do, but it's permitted in those committees, in those communities. So if you live in a poor neighborhood and you're having a hard time and you fall into the habit of, you know, sort of medicating yourself with any of a number of substances, whether it's crack or heroin or, you know, opiate pills, in sort of in poor white communities, that's a big problem.
The war on drugs began in June 1971 after President Nixon described drug abuse as the public enemy number one. Nixon increased federal funding for drug control agencies and drug treatment efforts, allegedly out of concern for the nation's health.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive. I have asked the Congress to provide the legislative authority and the funds to fuel this kind of an offensive. This will be a worldwide offensive dealing with the problems of sources of supply as well as Americans who may be stationed abroad, wherever they are in the world. It will be government-wide, pulling together the nine different fragmented areas within the government in which this problem is now being handled. And it will be nationwide in terms of a new educational program.
In reality, the war on drugs mostly impacted minority groups, particularly the black communities. Decades after Nixon's war, the African Americans are still much more likely to be arrested and incarcerated for drug-related offenses. The disproportionate effect that the war has had on the people of color is a living proof that the U.S. war on drugs is racist.
Clearly, the drug laws are used as a kind of hammer that the police can apply to poor neighborhoods, particularly inner city neighborhoods. They're able to use it as a pretense to stop people and search people. These charges, they're not insignificant to, I mean, I think that one of the major ramifications for the drug laws is just that people get into the criminal justice system, and then once you get a record in this country for a significant crime, it's very hard to get back on track.
Crack cocaine is not exactly the most popular heavy drug in America today, but Americans have 1,000 new ways to get addicted. The opioid crisis gripping the country today is one serious issue, emanating from corruption among the most powerful men in the country. Overdose deaths in the United States may have topped 90,000 in 2020, according to some estimates, but the opioid crisis is not getting enough attention due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet that is about to change as more and more people die or share their suffering due to addiction.
No police officer has ever helped anybody who's struggling with addiction to combat that addiction. Addicts are sick people. Most addicts come out of an extremely traumatizing social milieu. They have deep PTSD in their own past, in most cases, and they're looking for an escape. So putting more police, more repression, and sentencing laws in courts, this is not helping the most marginalized communities. I think DMX embodied this very reality. He is really a young man. He died last week. He was only 50 years old.
Opioid consumption is nothing new, and the rapid increase in overdoses has pushed authorities to find a solution. Some states are hit harder than the others. It was synthetic and semi-synthetic drugs, such as Percocet, Vicodin, OxyContin, and fentanyl, that caused the crisis.
So what do we do about this? Two paths forward, a short term and a long term. In the short term, we need to prevent creating new opiate dependent patients. In the long term, reform a system that created this. Studies do not support the use of these medicines for management of chronic pain. If you have back, joint, neck pain, do not start these medicines. They don't work in the long term. Medical assisted therapy helps patients who have developed opiate use disorder, but is a very imperfect solution. It cuts your rate of overdose in about half, but your risk of death is still 3 to 5 times higher if you're on medical-assisted therapy than if you never developed the problem at all.
The opioids were, of course, prescribed by doctors, but apparently their dependency does not let off. As patients fail to get their hands on the drug, after a while, they turn to chasing the dragon, which is both cheaper and more accessible. But how has the public's attitude towards drugs changed today?
The public's attitudes on drugs really haven't changed significantly. In fact, if anything, you could argue that since the Reagan years, we've gone in the other direction. Since the early 90s, we really strongly started to push this new concept of policing, this sort of broken windows, stop and frisk, community policing, whatever you want to call it, which stressed busting people for whatever they possibly could. Which included anything from, sort of public urination to open container laws to the most minor drug laws, even cigarette violations.
Prescription of opioid drugs dramatically grew between 1991 and 2011, along with their potency. And by 2012, 1 in 3 drug users were being prescribed the medicine. How all that came about could offer a glimpse into the way corporations work in America, particularly in the strong pharmaceutical sector. The drug abusers, however, are the ones to suffer.
Using opioids chronically changes your body and how your body handles things. So taking the opioids away is really, really hard. If you have to take the opioids away, I think, you have to argue to do it in a really slow fashion. You have to somehow get the patient on board and get the patient engaged with this process. and you have to try to address the other issues that they have.
Drug companies and the federal government embarked on pushing for prescription of painkiller opioids and ended what they called opioid phobia. The result has been horrendous. As a result, Americans die every day from an opioid overdoses.
There was never a popularization of heroin in sort of upscale white communities. Like that. Of course it had some users, but in order to really, you know, expand the market, it took the creation of something like OxyContin, which, you know, obviously is not quite as strong as heroin, but it was a different deliverable that opened opiates up to a broad new market. Now suddenly it's everyone from upper class people who have pain problems to sort of working class people in small communities.
The Biden administration has indicated taking a different path. President Biden and Vice President Harris themselves have notorious records on drug enforcement. Decades ago, then-Senator Joe Biden established himself as a sort of drug czar on Capitol Hill. Biden is certainly considered one of the architects of the modern war on drugs.
The president says he wants to wage a war on drugs, but if that's true, what we need is another D-Day, not another Vietnam, not another limited war fought on the cheap and destined for stalemate and human tragedy.
Biden's son, Hunter, has also been struggling with alcohol and drug addiction for years. And for a while, he even had to cook his own crack cocaine. President Biden has proposed mandatory treatment programs as a replacement for incarceration of those in possession of drugs.
Yeah, let's not forget Biden's role in the 1995 war on Black America, war on working class America, when the Clintons gutted the welfare state as we knew it then, which of course impacted the poorest of the poor in this country. So our expectations from Biden are not high at all. He may do this or that patchwork, small incremental concessions, but it won't have any significant impact on what is the pandemic before the pandemic. Opioids across this country take on average about 100,000 lives from us every day.
Even if Biden takes a different path in the war on drugs, he is unlikely to bring about real change. The narrowly divided Congress does not seem capable of passing any major drug reform legislation, although there is a whole lot of potential for change in the executive branch alone.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to further endanger the lives of vulnerable people, especially people who are incarcerated or use drugs, addressing the overdose crisis is a must. Meanwhile, many medically vulnerable individuals remain in prisons over minor crimes related to possession of drugs.
If you go back and look, you'll find a speech, I think it was on the floor of the Senate, a long time ago, where Biden was talking about, I believe he was talking about rave parties, and he was proposing that the government just bulldoze all of them, and when the subject of what law would be needed to do that came up, he said that we should find the rationale. That was Biden's quote, that we just need to find the rationale to go after drug dealers. So he's very much always been kind of a pro-prohibition type of politician.
The former president assumed that his proposed wall for the Mexican border could alleviate the crisis by halting flow of narcotics into the United States. He failed to build that wall, and even if he had managed to do so, it would have still been quite unlikely for it to affect the crisis, which has had a disproportionate impact on white suburbanites and rural areas.
We had 761 people die from overdose in our city of 620,000 people. When addiction was something that seemed to affect poor people of color in inner cities, that it was seen as a moral failing, a choice. And therefore, if you made a bad choice and you end up incarcerated or dead, it's your fault. Unless we address these deep-rooted issues, we're not going to really make progress in treating addiction as the disease that we know it to be.
We are joined tonight by Mr. Abdus Shahid Lukman. He is the co-founder of Lukman Nation Media. And I'm glad you're with us tonight, Mr. Lukman, because we're discussing DMX, and there's a narrative out there, and it's pretty powerful, that sees elevated rates of drug usage in oppressed communities. It sees drug usage portrayed in hip-hop music, and it assumes that there is a link between the two. So what can you tell us about DMX, about his life, his music, his struggle with addiction, and about the broader context in which elevated drug use exists in economically and racially oppressed communities?
Well, I'd like to first state that music, drug usage, substance abuse has always been part of the entertainment scene. So, you know, I've been, ever since DMX's passing, it's been made to seem that, you know, DMX was, and he did suffer, you know, substance abuse issues. You know, the way that he rapped, like his style of rapping was like chaotic. And it sort of was like representative of that time. That time period was chaotic. You know, and so, you know, I know some people who haven't like lived through that may see his rap style as being somewhat, you know, maybe comical or, you know, or sort of like maniacal, but during that time, it connected with us because not only was our communities chaotic because of the drug trade, and not only the drug trade, but the government's response to that, which I felt was ironic, because it was the government that facilitated that caused this. You know, a lot of your audiences, people know about the CIA's connection to the crack cocaine epidemic. You know, they got a show out called Snowfall that kind of chronicalizes some of that. And you know, how the United States government sacrificed our community in order to fund these covert operations that they had down in Nicaragua. And just basically just sacrificed our community, which was already under stress due to you know, racism and all the negatives that our community was already stressed by, from just discrimination and racism and white supremacy and all those other things. So now you bring this, and you know, look, it was just too much for any community to handle.
Definitely pretty tough to argue with that. Well, we want to thank you so much, Mr. Lukman, for joining us tonight. We want to thank audiences at home for doing the same. For Press TV's We the People in Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed.
DMX's tragic death at the age of 50 is a warning call for the U.S. government to take serious action. Whether there is a solution on the horizon remains to be seen. Well, that was our show. I'm your host, Mila Javamagi. Thank you.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
the limelight.
A fairly recent study which looked at the attacks on the Asian American community between 1992 and 2014 suggested that almost 75% of attacks against the community were carried out by white perpetrators. To those familiar with the history of the United States, this should come as no surprise. We now present you an article written by Richard Sudan, a journalist, writer, and TV reporter. The piece is titled, African Americans Not Responsible for Asian Hate Crimes. Please stay with us for more of Richard Sudan's article. There's a dangerous myth which continues to circulate in the media over the last few weeks, and certainly on social media. It's a myth because it's false and amounts to dangerously misleading propaganda which could significantly and negatively impact black people, already dealing with serious and ongoing systemic injustice. That myth is the pernicious idea that African Americans are somehow the main culprits and new face of racism in the United States, responsible for the widely reported anti-Asian hate crimes. This claim seems to be based on a few videos shared on social media, which appears to show black individuals randomly attacking Asian Americans. But there is a problem with how these videos have been widely interpreted. The videos themselves purport to show individuals who are not proven to have been attached to an ideology. Many have also argued they are homeless or possibly mentally ill. Although they might be black, they're not representative of the black community. The presumption that their actions are somehow reflective of the African-American community as a whole is in itself racist. But for many, the narrative being pushed, which seeks to apportion blame for the attacks on the Asian community, on the black community, is not an accident. They argue that ultimately what is playing out is a misleading distraction from the very real white supremacy surfacing in the United States, visible on 6th of January and potentially also in the recent killings of six Asian American women by Robert Aaron Long. Filmmaker and social commentator Tariq Nasheed offered a damning critique of the last few weeks. Nasheed said, "The white supremacist lawmakers in the United States are orchestrating a backlash against black Americans as a form of revenge for the anti-black racism protests that captivated the global community last year after the lynching of George Floyd. Now they are orchestrating a false narrative of a blacks against Asians crime wave to use as a deflection from the anti-black racism that we suffer from the system of white supremacy." Strong words, no doubt, but a look at the data in the United States is also compelling. A fairly recent study which looked at the attacks on the Asian American community between 1992 and 2014 suggested that almost 75% of those attacks against the community were carried out by white perpetrators. To those familiar with the history of the United States, this should come as no surprise. A few recent videos visible on social media representing individual attacks would have been unlikely to dent that trend. In addition, Stuart Liu, the head of the New York Police Department's Anti-Asian Hate Crimes Task Force, recently had this to say. "Leaders of the black community were the first and most vocal in publicly condemning the surge in hate crimes against Asian Americans." This statement seems clear enough, but it is not something being widely reported on. And furthermore, the tradition of the black community condemning racist attacks is not new and stretches back many years. Indeed, the great abolitionist Frederick Douglass once expressed his support for Chinese immigrants in the context of the prejudice they faced before he himself and his community were even afforded the rights they should have had. Commentators and media suggesting the new face of racism in the United States belongs to black people in the context of anti-Asian hate crimes is malicious. Focusing on non-white arrests in areas like New York City, as some have, could be countered by the fact that these locations are actually places with greater non-white populations to begin with. But commentators twisting things to suit an anti-black narrative are simply being deliberately disingenuous. The fact is, the whole world has been questioning more and more the depth and extent of white supremacy in the United States, especially over the last year. If anything can account for the reprehensible anti-Asian attacks, it is the already existing issue of long-standing racism in the United States, which has long plagued the country. And what might have further contributed to an upsurge in anti-Asian attacks are the words expressed by former President Donald Trump, who repeatedly described the coronavirus as the Chinese virus. White supremacy as an ideology is at the foundation of the country. It's hundreds of years old and knows how to preserve itself. People should bear this in mind when watching the news and perhaps keep in mind the wisdom of the great African-American Muslim leader Malcolm X. If you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are being oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing. Black communities have been and remain the victims of racism in the United States. The false narrative of trying to paint them as the perpetrators of racism is simply absurd and dangerous.
Ministry.
Iraqi Kurds, long accused of covert cozy ties with Zionist Israel, are watching on with amazement as Israel befriends allegedly hostile Arab countries. Normalization between Arab countries and Israel are changing their tragic realities for them. After the occupation arrived in 1948 and as Arab hostility toward constant Israeli aggression intensified, the occupying entity tried to reach out to non-Arab communities in West Asia. It found an opening with Iraq's Kurds, who had a dream to separate from the central government in Baghdad. Israel then sought to provide military support to Kurds who were fighting Saddam Hussein's military campaigns in the north throughout the 1980s and the 1990s. In 2017, Israel backed a controversial independence referendum in northern Iraq, even as Erbil's allies, including the United States, opposed the vote. And now, as the Kurds watch several states normalizing with the region's historic foe Israel, they feel eager to take their relationship with Israeli intelligence and occupation forces out to the open, but they cannot do it on their own. They need Iraq to do it first, since Baghdad manages foreign policy. If an Israeli embassy opens in Baghdad tomorrow, the day after, an Israeli consulate will be open in Erbil. This is what KRG officials openly say. However, the Iraqi resistance has a different opinion. Regional media reported last week that an Israeli Mossad outpost came under attack in northern Iraq Tuesday, April 13 at night, and that a senior Israeli intelligence agent was killed while several other Mossad agents were wounded. Such incidents, along with the constant attacks against U.S. occupation forces in Erbil Airport, puts leaders of the KRG at a hot spot for not being able to keep their regions away from harm's way by engaging in unholy alliances with Iraq's main foes, Israel and the U.S. By supporting Kurdish separatism, Israel hopes to steer the region in a new direction and by extension encourage other ethnic and religious groups in the region to seek to emulate the Kurdish example. By deliberately seeking to dismantle the existing multi-ethnic, multicultural, and multi-religious nation states, Israel's quest to be recognized as a purely Jewish state would no longer be an aberration, or so it hopes. But we already know that it is not going to happen as long as the region's resistance is alive and capable. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mala Osman. The Kurds are fond of saying that they have no friends but the mountains. Yet one entity has pushed for their separation from both Iraq and Syria over many decades, Israel. The relationship between the two has evolved to the point where Israel is the only voice in West Asia encouraging rather than decrying the Kurdistan separation from Iraq. Netanyahu first publicly voiced support for an independent Kurdish state in June 2014 as the threat of Daesh was rising. However, that fantasy was blocked by the Iraqi resistance's elimination of Daesh, ridding the Kurdish Contras from Daesh threat. Yet Kurdish separatists still choose Israel over the resistance any day. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, this is a very interesting topic here, specifically that the leaders of northern Iraq's Kurdistan regional government are always happy to receive Israeli support, given the international opposition to the Kurdish plans to disintegrate from Iraq. We have Kurdish leaders who could not openly celebrate their Israeli encouragement for fear of repercussions from the rest of Iraq, who link aspirations for Kurdish independence with the ideology of Zionism itself, which we have been seeing for the past 72 years. In what ways do you think the Kurdish separatists believe Israel can actually benefit their demands?
It's the same delusion that many before the Kurds have fallen into, and well, here we're talking about a small minority that is requesting the support of an imperialist against its own region. And we remember what happened to the indigenous tribes in Mexico when they sided, some of them, with the Spanish invaders against the Aztecs. And obviously the Spanish, as soon as we're done with the Aztecs, eliminated and ethnically cleansed those indigenous small tribes. And so it's a delusion for any person to side with imperialists against the people of his region, his or her region. And there's never been in history that this ended well. And it seems like the elite in the Kurdish people have not learned from history.
Well, the Kurdish regional government released an official statement last week on Wednesday denying certain reports that were present in the media, especially in the regional media, claiming that there were unknown forces that attacked a certain area, and which is a Mossad facility in the KRG, and it killed Israelis in northern Iraq. Now, at the same time, we have attacks on U.S. Bases all across Iraq, especially those who are stationed in Kurdistan, and now possible attacks against Mossad agents as well. What will be the result of such constant upheaval in northern Iraq that was once safer than actually Baghdad?
You see, the result will be continued fighting in the region. As long as the Kurds do not reconciliate with their surrounding, with their brothering and cousins in Iran, in Turkey, in the Arabic world, they will continue to be played by imperialist and apartheid Israel for the goals of not achieving them peace or stability or independence, but to undermine their brothers and neighbors. That's the ultimate goal that apartheid Israel is working on. That's the ultimate goal of the United States involvement in Iraq and Syria on the side of the Kurds. It is not for their betterment, it's for the detriment of everybody else around them, which means they will also, their house will be burning down with their surrounding. You know, you look at what's happening in North Iraq right now with the ethnic cleansing of Nineveh, of the Babylonian and Assyrian and Syriac and Arab peoples of that region, and the after the invasion of ISIS and the Wahhabi contras, and how these Kurdish contras themselves actually, instead of after the defeat of ISIS in that region, allowing the people of the indigenous populations of that region to come back, have taken it over and included it in their fake new independent province or area of Iraq. So we have now Kurds that are encroaching on the traditional lands of Semitic people, Assyrians, Babylonian, and Arab, and this will not end well.
Well, this sort of covert relationship between both the Kurdish side and the Israeli side began when the Ba'ath Party was still in power between 1968 and 1975. It was the most where they shared intel, and even Israel gave weapons to Kurdistan to fight off at that time Saddam Hussein. But we had Mustafa Barzani, the father of the current president of the KRG, Masoud Barzani. He was leading a rebellion against the Iraqi regime at that time. Now, Israeli security and intelligence agents help the Kurds with military assistance and with also arms. What benefits Israel from this relationship? Obviously, other than having a foot inside of Iraq, what can they benefit from a disintegrated region?
You see, the goal of apartheid Israel in the Western Asia and North Africa, one of their main goals since the creation of Zionism, is to cut off the rivers that feed the Arab people. We're here talking about the Euphrates and the Tigris and the Nile. And so you look at how the relationship between apartheid Israel, Turkey, and Ethiopia are very important into holding our people down. And, you know, and as we see right now in Egypt, the situation is deteriorating. You know, building this dam in Ethiopia will basically starve the people of Egypt. And here is the same thing happening in the Levant. The Turks built, 40-somewhat dams on the Euphrates and Tigris, and now the Kurds are coming to steal the lands that are the part of the Fertile Crescent that fed the Arab and the Semitic people for 40,000 years, you know, the land between the two rivers. So the aim here is to cut off the Arabic people from their ability to feed themselves, because that's one of the things that have kept the Arab people independent and able to resist imperialism and occupation for 20,000 years.
Well, given the past 10 years of war against terrorism, the region waged by the resistance against imperial powers who implanted hostile terrorists, Wahhabi-funded insurgents, and Westerns one in the region in total, especially in Iraq and in the areas controlled by the Kurds as well in northern Iraq, they suffered a lot until the Iraqi resistance led by both martyrs, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis and Qasem Soleimani, went to help out, especially in Kirkuk, and rid the area of Daesh. Why is it so hard for the leaders of the KRG to accept that and to take a firm stance alongside the resistance, the Iraqi resistance, whom they share with the land, the sky, the nation, the pride?
Well, you know, unfortunate for the Kurdish people that they are cursed with such leadership that cannot even acknowledge a favor that was done to them and the saving of the Kurdish people in Iraq from these Wahhabi contras that would have, you know, kidnapped and raped and all their children and women and killed their men if they were able to. So, you know, we know that the Kurdish people is different than their elite, and their elite, unfortunately, are corrupted to the bone, where their care is not about protecting their people. It's about stealing as much money as possible through the looting of the Iraqi oil, now the Syrian oil also, and taking all the money that comes in from the West and the weapons. And, you know, so you look at what's happening in Kurdistan, Iraq, And the disparity between this political elite and the people on the ground is huge. And ultimately, the hope is that there will be new movements within the Kurdish people that will, you know, push these elites out that are collaborating with imperialists.
Well, that remains to be seen as how the region is actually beginning to look like one which is waiting for fire to happen, or rather diplomacy to work throughout its sway. I want to thank you very much, Leith Maarouf, for being with us, political commentator in Beirut, to talk about the relationship between Israel and the Kurds of Iraq. Now, please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. bases in Iraq are being shot one after the other.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Another military base hosting U.S. troops in Iraq was targeted with drones carrying explosives on Wednesday morning, ending any illusions that President Joe Biden's strike on Iraqi resistance soldiers inside Syria would deter such retaliatory attacks. Now, no casualties were reported in the attack on the airport in Erbil, which doubles as a base for U.S. troops. Now, before U.S. occupation troops shook off the Erbil attack, another one hit them on Friday in the Ain al-Assad base located in the Anbar governorate of western Iraq. U.S. occupation bases under heavy fire across Iraq in this following report.
Renewed drone attacks on U.S. targets in Iraq show that the Iraqi resistance is keen on ridding its nation from U.S. occupation, as U.S. pressure on the government in Baghdad is heaping, while Biden seeks leverage over the Iraqi official decision to see the U.S. leave their country once and for all. Iraq, scarred by decades of U.S. invasion, war, and Western-backed terrorism, has been a strategic location for the U.S. occupation to face off with its main foe, Iran, while making sure that the Iraqi popular choice of resistance be suppressed. The resumption of retaliatory attacks against U.S. occupation bases in Iraq shows that the Iraqi resistance are now abandoning de-escalation and seeking leverage over their rivals. It seems we're back to last year when, for several months in 2020, rockets rained down on American sites once a week or more. However, this time, not only in Anbar or Baghdad, but also in northern Iraq's Kurdistan region. A drone dropped explosives targeting U.S. occupation forces stationed at Erbil Airport in northern Iraq late on Wednesday, April 14, with no reports of casualties. However, a separate rocket attack killed a Turkish soldier at a military base nearby. It was the first known attack carried out by an unmanned aerial drone against U.S. forces in Erbil, amid a steady stream of rocket attacks on bases hosting U.S. occupation forces and their embassy in Baghdad that Washington blames on what it calls Iran-backed militias. The U.S. still cannot fathom the thought that Iraqis have every right to defend their land, especially after their tragic history of the American invasion, occupation, theft, and embedding Takfiri terrorism. Shortly before Wednesday's attack in Erbil, at least two rockets landed on a base to the west of the city that hosts Turkish forces, killing a Turkish soldier. Turkey also has troops in Iraq, both as part of a NATO contingent and a force that has attacked Kurdish separatist militants in the north. The Iraqi resistance had already expressed its opposition to the presence of the United States and Turkey and demand a full withdrawal of all foreign troops. But since all their words went unheard, they sought a louder form of expression, which definitely got the attention of all foreign occupation forces in Iraq.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Malmo is Firas Ali, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Firas. Now, Iraqi resistance factions have upped the stakes with drone attacks against U.S. occupation forces inside of Iraq, a technique which is actually favored elsewhere in West Asia, and it seems to be affordable, yet very accurate and very effective. Are we at a crossroad for the U.S. illegal presence in Iraq, or maybe is this the storm before actual big explosion that might happen.
The Iraqi resistance has chosen a very strategic offensive against the U.S. occupation. This choice is very accurate, and it doesn't risk Iraqi civilians' lives, neither through their own action or through rough and disproportionate reactions from the U.S. occupation. It's enough headache and damage for the civilian Iraqis that their lives are endangered by the U.S. missile defense, air missile defense system that they use around the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Because usually, and it's very often actually, that shrapnels from that missile defense system drops down on civilian houses and damages it. The Iraqi resistance are therefore slowly choking the occupation, and this will make them bleed to death. A big explosion could occur if the Americans make a stupid mistake, like, for example, a bigger operation against the resistance.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't seem to be in the planning, at least not openly. I think the Americans would instead certainly prefer pushing Iraqi security forces against the resistance, and thus both having an internal fight and getting a pause from the attacks. Hopefully that won't happen.
Well, Firas, the U.S. has been planning to leave Baghdad, especially the Green Zone in Baghdad, and move north towards Erbil, away from the constant attacks by certain Iraqi groups that don't really name themselves or give a bit of a vague name for themselves. Yet they now find themselves being attacked, and people are following them up there and attacking them because they are not welcome in Iraq. What are the U.S. options when it comes to dealing with such specific drone attacks?
The Americans have only one option on. Let's make use of their favorite phrase, as we got to use it. Although it was a long time that they used it themselves, they used to say that all options are on the table. I think the Iraqi resistance are telling the Americans now, you have only one option on the table, and that's leaving Iraq. It doesn't matter where in Iraq you move, we will follow you there. If they don't leave Iraq, they will have to face the consequences. As you mentioned, we've seen in the region, and especially in the U.S.-backed Saudi war on Yemen, the U.S. defense system can't protect the kingdom from this kind of kamikaze drones, regardless of how expensive or the state of the art they are. This is actually making the Americans very irritated. Expensive defense system can't protect them against cheap but effective drones.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of drones are probably even safer for the Iraqi resistance than missiles, because they can send them from a distance without a bigger security setup, and they don't leave any traces.
Well, politically, the U.S. keeps poking at the Iraqi government, at Qaddafi's government, after every attack it faces inside of Iraqi territories, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament considers the Iraqi resistance part of the Iraqi army since 2017. And so basically, when the U.S. targets the Iraqi resistance, it is basically targeting the Iraqi army itself. Where does Qaddafi's government stand on this very crucial matter?
Well, it seems that the interim government of Qaddafi are trying to balance between the occupation and the request of the parliament, which in fact is the wish of the Iraqi people. The government is actually engaged in a dialogue with the representatives of the United States of America in Iraq. They're talking about a withdrawal, but regardless, the Iraqi people are receiving mixed signals. The interim government says that the troops will leave, but spokesman for the occupation army says another thing. Sometimes they're talking about moving north to northern Iraq, and sometimes you can hear the Secretary General of NATO saying that they will replace the U.S. occupation. So it's hard to know who is the honest guy here in the room. But U.S. forces have decreased in Iraq, and that's a fact. But I don't think it's because of the dialogue. I think it's because of the security concerns they have amid the ongoing attacks.
Well,
but that's not enough.
We have seen once again that the Iraqi file is pressing the Biden administration to make some sort of a firm stance towards its presence, its troops' presence inside of Iraq, its illegal presence inside of Iraq. But Biden seems